Well met, and welcome to episode 103 of the Bill Shakespeare Project podcast for May the 24th, 2015. For our blog and previous podcast episodes, check us out at thebillshakespeareproject.com. Greetings. This is Bill Walthall, and in this podcast, we continue our three-month-long discussion of Hamlet with a look at Ophelia, botanicals, abortion, and suicide, possibly even assisted. When we last see Ophelia in Hamlet, in Act 4, Scene 5, she enters distract, singing snatches of songs, then, if her dialogue is any clue, handing out flowers. There's rosemary, that's for remembrance. Pray, you love, remember. And there is pansies, that's for thoughts. There's fennel for you, and columbines. There's rue for you, and here's some for me. We may call it herb of grace a Sundays. You must wear your rue with a difference. There's a daisy. I would give you some violets, but they all withered when my father died. They say he made a good end. Now, flora and fauna usually have some sort of symbolism attached, though it can be tricky as those connotations can change depending on the region and cultural differences. But from the research I've done, the flowers Ophelia mentions parse out something like this. Rosemary symbolizes remembrance, as she states. Pansies, as she states, is for thoughts, but more specifically, lovers' thoughts or merriment. Fennel can symbolize strength, but also sometimes flattery or deceit. And here, Ophelia isn't explicit. Columbine can mean both ingratitude, faithlessness, as well as courage, love, desertion, or sometimes even folly. But once again, she's not specific as how she means it. Herb of grace a Sunday, also known as rue, can mean regret, sorrow, repentance, but also grace, clear vision, even disdain. Daisy means innocence, hope, loyal love, purity, faith, cheer, simplicity, though sometimes dissembling. Violet, depending on the color, can mean faithfulness, loyalty, devotion, daydreaming, virtue, modesty. Now, there are no explicit stage directions as to who receives which flowers, and different productions approach the speech differently. In the Branagh film, Ophelia doesn't have flowers at all and is handing out nothings, and all to Laertes. In the staged version with Burton, directed by Gielgud, Ophelia enters with flowers, consciously drops them, then hands out imaginary ones. In the Zeffirelli version, she doesn't hand out flowers, but bones and sticks. And in still others, she gives all her flowers to a single recipient. I think there are some clues for the director and the actor playing Ophelia, and if we just go by symbolism, rosemary, remembrance, might go to Laertes, possibly in an echo of the ghosts imploring Hamlet, remember me. An urging of Laertes to revenge her death, possibly? Pansies? I would go with Ophelia keeping that for herself. There's no you connected to it verbally, and I could see her wanting to keep a lover's thoughts. Fennel and columbine, these could go to Claudius, as they both mean faithlessness and deceit, and I can clearly imagine Hamlet having complained to her about Claudius. Ophelia could give the rue to Gertrude, as they will share it, they're both women, but Gertrude must wear hers with a difference, maybe with a clear vision of the deceitful Claudius. I would have her keep the daisy, again the lack of the verbal cue you, and innocence fits the bill here. With violence, I see her coming full circle, coming back to Laertes, rewarding him for his loyalty and devotion. He's returned to her when her father is dead and gone, and Hamlet's just gone. Of course, there are no violets, so it's the words she's giving him, not the flower. Those might work, but what if the recipients don't have to do with symbolism? What if there were other meanings to the flowers, not symbolic, but rather medicinal? All of the flowers she mentions has some effect on the body. Some women used rosemary to increase menstrual flow. The pansy can be used to deaden pain, to increase bowel movements and urination, and to relieve inflammation. Some women used fennel to increase the flow of breast milk, to promote menstruation, to ease the birthing process, or even to increase the sex drive. Columbine can be used to shrink body tissues, to stimulate urination, to increase perspiration, and to deaden pain. Some women used rue to relieve menstrual problems and to stimulate the uterus. Daisies can be used to increase bowel movements and to alleviate stomach cramps. And violets can be used to alleviate depression and/or nervousness. Now, given these possible uses, the recipients change a little for me. Gertrude would get both the rosemary and the fennel. Both have female-centric medical uses. Laertes would receive both the pansy and the columbine, as they deaden pain. And the world of pain is the one her brother inhabits, from their father's death to her new mental state. Ophelia keeps some rue for herself and hands out at least one other bit of rue. It could be to Gertrude, again the female-centric use, or Claudius, for symbolism, as he must wear his rue with a difference. As he's not a woman, he cannot wear it by its medical purposes, but for the sorrow it connotes. But I think I might have Ophelia give both of them rue. Her kept one almost a conspiratorial aside to Gertrude. Women, unite! But still Claudius will have to wear his differently. The daisy I see tossed off, given to no one, as there's no use for it here. And of course, there is no violet to be given, but if it is, invisibly, I'd have her give it to everyone, except herself, to alleviate everyone's depression, except her own, which of course will lead to the description that we get from Gertrude just two scenes from now. I can hear the wheels turning out there, O listeners. But Bill, you say, this is her mad scene. Wouldn't this distribution take rational thought, as opposed to Shakespeare's hand guiding of symbolic gestures? And you would have a point, if she was mad. But what if she wasn't mad? She's distracted, explicitly, absolutely, thrown into a state of mind in which one knows not how to act, according to the Oxford English Dictionary, over the abandonments she's feeling, dead dad, enforced exiled lover. And note, distract's meaning of rendered insane was only beginning to come into use when the play was written. It feels more like desperation than madness to me. But what might make her this desperate? And here, I want to return to the rosemary and the rue. Because, my friends, both flowers could be used to cause an abortion. Go with me on this, folks. Polonius tells Ophelia in Act 1, 'Tis told him, Hamlet hath very oft of late given private time to you, and you yourself have of your audience been most free and bounteous. Not only has he heard that they've been spending private time together, but he also fears that she will tender him a fool or produce a child. And Hamlet even goads Polonius by warning Ophelia's father of her possible conception. When Hamlet meets Ophelia in Act 3, Scene 1, post To Be or Not to Be, their first onstage dialogue in the play, he greets her with, Nymph, in thy orisons be all my sins remembered. Note the use of the more familiar thee as opposed to the formal and emotionally distant you. I think we can feel fairly certain that Hamlet is not calling her a maiden inhabiting the sea, which limits nymph's meaning to either a beautiful young woman or a woman regarded as a means of sexual gratification. If she's the former and not the latter, he wouldn't need to have his sins be remembered in her prayers. And why would he ask if she was honest or chaste? So I'd argue for the more sexual reading. Of course I would. Now, riding the waves of the ripple effects of that sex, one has to ask if Hamlet was aware if Ophelia was pregnant. And I would argue no. His brutal attack of get thee to a nunnery seems to go after their sexual history simply, pointing to the whorehouse slang meaning of nunnery. It's ironic, and therefore even more painful, for him to also reference where many tarnished women were sent, a convent. And I'd argue that it's this pain that shell-shocks her. Verbally, she's never the same again after this meeting. This is the moment that begins the desperation that sends her, ultimately, to her death. But before that death, we get this one last cry for help from Ophelia, a cry accompanied with flowers. Now, let's take this interpretation out to its seeming logical conclusion. Why does Ophelia commit suicide? Without the possible pregnancy, the losses of her father and then Hamlet are the usual suspects. Those make sense and cannot be denied as possibilities. But they do have an impact on any pregnancy-related suicide as well. Because any form of protection for Ophelia from society, either by her father where her lover is now removed. If she is pregnant, when did the conception occur? Well, let's do some math. The actions of Acts 2 and 3 take place roughly 2 months after the plot points of Act 1. It's conceivable, pun totally intended, that Hamlet had been back at Elsinore for no more than a month before the events of Act 1, since we know that old Hamlet's death took place about 2 months before the beginning of the play. And as we noted earlier, Polonius has heard that Hamlet and Ophelia have been spending time together, enough time together that Laertes is prompted to speak to Ophelia about the relationship too. So the earliest the conception could have taken place, remember, Hamlet was away at school, is what we'll call Act 1 minus a month. The latest would probably be Act 1 plus a month, as by this point his antic disposition would probably have taken over and their relationship probably devolved pretty quickly. So by the time of Hamlet's killing of Polonius and enforced departure for England, Ophelia could have been anywhere between 1 and 3 months pregnant. But how long has it been between the killing of Polonius and the events of Act 4, Scene 5, when we see Ophelia's breakdown? It has to be less than 2 months, as, at the most, that's the period of time between the death of old Hamlet and the events of Act 1. Both young Hamlet and Laertes were present for that, and Laertes was away in France when he received both death notices. But I'm thinking that 2 months is stretching it. I'm thinking 1 month, 6 weeks tops. But one has to remember that Laertes has been at Elsinore for at least a little while, both before the start of the play, he had come for the coronation, which was clearly in the past, and he is anxious to return, and here in Act 4, as he has had enough time to attract followers to call for him to be king. So let's say it's a total of 6 weeks between Act 4, Scenes 4 and 5. This would make Ophelia anywhere between 2.5 and 4.5 months pregnant. Now, by this point, Ophelia would be well aware of her own pregnancy and well aware that she would soon begin to show outward signs of it. Or maybe she's already showing, as Horatio, when attempting to convince Gertrude to grant an audience with Ophelia, uses an interesting phrase. "'Twere good she were spoken with, for she may strew dangerous conjectures in ill-breeding minds." To speak to one could allow for that person to be out in public. To speak with that person, however, connotes bringing them into private, where she might not raise eyebrows or rumors. Also interesting, Horatio's use of breeding in his sentence. It might very well have a pointed use here. Regardless, Ophelia needs a way out. By the use of rosemary and rue, I'll argue that she has attempted a chemical abortion, but has not, at least to her knowledge, succeeded. She makes a desperate plea for help. Only after knowing that she has access to the Queen in the first half of Act 4, Scene 5, does she return to bring her coded flower message to Gertrude. The message is sent, but is it received? Gertrude certainly doesn't mention it. Of course, Gertrude says nothing from this point in the play until she enters to announce Ophelia's death 2 scenes later. Her silence here could be tacit acknowledgement of the receipt of message, of a secret shared and kept. Now, when we next see Gertrude and hear of Ophelia, it is when the Queen informs Claudius and Laertes of Ophelia's demise. "There is a willow grows askant the brook that shows his hoar leaves in the glassy stream. Therewith fantastic garlands did she make of crow flowers, nettles, daisies, and long purples that liberal shepherds give a grosser name, but our cold maids do dead men's fingers call them. There, on the pendant boughs, her coronet weeds, clamoring to hang, an envious sliver broke, when down her weedy trophies and herself fell in the weeping brook. Her clothes spread wide, and mermaid-like a while they bore her up, which time she chanted snatches of old lauds, as one incapable of her own distress, or like a creature native and endued to that element. But long it could not be till that her garments, heavy with their drink, pulled the poor wretch from her melodious lay to muddy death." Is it just me? Or is this account far too descriptive to be second-hand? Gertrude's version of the story contains sensory details of both sight, clothes spread wide, mermaid-like, and sound. She chanted snatches of old lauds that simply could not exist without first-hand experience. Gertrude was there, having received Ophelia's coded cry for help and had attended to her needs. Now, it's unclear if this is a poetic spin, a beautified cover story of simple suicide, or a truthful depiction of the event. I'd like to believe it's the latter, with Ophelia being incapable of her own distress. In other words, a peaceful release of life rather than a desperate extinguishing of it. But I'm troubled. Why, you ask? Again, the speech. Gertrude describes a willow that is next to a brook or stream. Ophelia, at this willow, made fantastic wreaths and headdresses from many kinds of flowers. Ophelia, trying to hang her flowers on a thin branch, climbed out onto the branch, which then broke. She and her artifacts then fell into the brook. Her clothes spread out from her, and for a while they held her above the water. During this time, she sang like someone who is unafraid or like a water creature. But the clothes, soaked with water, then pulled her from the surface to her death. How exactly is this suicide? If suicide is an act of taking one's own life, self-murder, as the OED defined it in Shakespeare's day, then this doesn't seem like suicide. She crawled out onto a branch, it broke, and she drowned. Accidental. But then why is Gertrude there if not to assist? To verify? And if so, of what? That the suicide succeeded? Or to come back with a story of accidental death? Is the verification needed to ensure a burial with full Christian rites? Let's say that last one is the reason. If so, then Gertrude did a pretty awful job, because in the next scene we see Ophelia not receiving full rites. Or is it because it's still suicide if Ophelia doesn't make an effort to make it back to shore? But then, why would she if she felt no fear, as if native to the water? Regardless, her situation, as if Gertrude's story was so easily discarded as a fiction, becomes the grist of a sort of philosophical joke by the gravedigger. For here lies the point. If I drown myself wittingly, it argues an act, and an act hath three branches. It is to act, to do, to perform. Argal, she drowned herself wittingly. Give me leave. Here lies the water. Good. Here stands the man. Good. If the man go to this water and drown himself, it is, will he, nil he goes. Mark you that. But if the water come to him and drown him, he drowns not himself. Argal, he that is not guilty of his own death shortens not his own life. I find amusing the gravedigger's use of branches, as if he knew the cover story. Then he discusses the separate locations of the water and the victim and which goes to meet which. In a sense, the water did come to Ophelia. But it doesn't matter now. There will be no rites. Gertrude fails both in not keeping Ophelia safe and alive, as well as not being able to make her spiritual trip to the afterlife a religious one. What guilt might Gertrude have felt? And is this why she prays for a kingly pardon from Claudius as she drinks the poisoned cup? Does she pray for his pardon because she knows that she will not receive one from God? Does she drink the poison knowingly, seeking to follow her fallen sister? Again, this play, it creates more questions than it even begins to answer. Now, if you've enjoyed this podcast, but you haven't been following along with our daily blog entries the last couple of weeks, you've missed out on subjects including Too Young, Too Old, Hamlet Stuck in the Middle, maybe, Parallels, Right Angles, and A Glimpse into the Future, Gertrude's Guilt, T.S. Eliot Does Not Like Hamlet, Harold Bloom Loves Hamlet, Ophelia and Her Flowers, Symbols, Ophelia and Her Flowers, Uses, Ophelia and Her Flowers, Aftermath, Suicidal Tendencies and Questions, Playing with Hamlet, A Concordance View, Stage Directions in Dialogue, and Acting Clues in Verse. So, if you'd like more in-depth discussions or just want a daily fix, check out the blog entries at thebillshakespeareproject.com or become a fan of our Facebook page and our Twitter feed. Remember that those social media outlets are more for Shakespeare news and notes than for discussions of our current play under study. Also, if you have any question or comment about this or any other Bill Shakespeare Project podcast or blog entry, you can always lob me an email at bill@thebillshakespeareproject.com. And join us again next week for our next podcast as we finally wrap up Hamlet. We hope to see you then. You've been listening to the Bill Shakespeare Project podcast for May the 24th, 2015. For our blog and previous podcast episodes, check us out at thebillshakespeareproject.com. And we shall see thee anon.